The Theravada is based on the Pali Tipitaka, or three baskets. That is to say, the Vinaya Pitaka, the basket or collection of monastic discipline, the Sutta Pitaka, the basket or collection of the Buddha's sayings and discourses, and the Abhidhamma Pitaka, the basket or collection of further, i.e. more philosophical teaching, as well as upon the various commentaries to these texts. So far, at least, we have tended to derive inspiration and guidance from what appear to be the older portions of the Tipitaka, especially from the Sutta Nipata, the Udana, the Itivuttaka, the Dhammapada, and the Thera and Theri Gatha, all of which belong to the Sutta Pitaka, as do the Digha and Majjhima Nikaya, select discourses from which are also a source of inspiration and guidance for some of us. The only non-canonical Theravada text to which we have regular recourse is Buddha Ghosha's Visuddhimagga, the second section of which on Samadhi is particularly useful. All the texts I have mentioned inculcate harmlessness, non-attachment, tranquility, contentment, forbearance, kindness, mindfulness, effort, and discrimination. And it is these which are the general characteristics of the Theravada at its best, as well as being among the essential, definitive qualities of the spiritual life. The same texts also give us, between them, a more vivid impression of the Buddha in his enlightened human historical reality than do any other scriptures, with the possible exception of such portions of the Sanskrit counterparts of the Sutta Pitaka as survive in the original language or in Chinese and Tibetan translation. This does not mean that the historical necessarily excludes the legendary. As Reginald A. Ray has lately reminded us, Western and modernist notions of a demythologized individuality standing apart from and independent of symbol, cult, and legend have no relevance for the early Buddhist case. Gautama, in his own time and in subsequent times, was able to be the Buddha precisely because he was understood to embody in an unprecedented way the cosmic and transcendent. Far from being incidental to who he was, myths and cult define his essential person, for his earliest followers as for later Buddhists. In my own words, commenting on Ray's assertion, we come closest to the historical Buddha precisely when we take the legendary and cultic idiom of his hagiographical tradition most seriously. That we are able to come close to the Buddha at all and to derive inspiration and guidance from his personal example as well as from his actual teaching is largely owing to the fact that we have access to the older portions of the Tipitaka, and we are accordingly grateful to the Theravada for having preserved them. Various selections from the Pali Canon, illustrative of the Buddha's life as well as of his teaching, are available. One of the best of these is Bhikkhu Nyanamoli's The Life of the Buddha, which is well known to many of us, as is Dr. B.R. Ambedkar's The Buddha and His Dhamma. The three remaining schools, being schools of the Mahayana, are all based ultimately on the Mahayana Sutras, though they may have a closer connection with some sutras than with others. There are hundreds of Mahayana sutras, by no means all of which have been translated into any European language. Those from which we have so far derived the greatest inspiration and guidance, and they happen to be among the most important Mahayana scriptures, are the Prajnaparamita Sutras, especially the Diamond and Heart Sutras, the Saddharma Pundarika Sutra, the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, and the Survana Prabhasha Sutra. All these works are distinguished by universality of outlook, philosophical profundity, and a willingness on the part of most of them to communicate spiritual truths by non-conceptual means, all of which are general characteristics of the schools based on them. They all proclaim, moreover, the Bodhisattva ideal, the ideal of absolute spiritual altruism, which in one form or other is the chosen ideal of all schools of the Mahayana. Pure Land Buddhism is based on the two Sukhavati Viha Sutras, the larger and the smaller, and on the Amitayura Dhyana Sutra. All three works describe Sukhavati, the blissful, the pure land of the Buddha Amitabha, as well as describing Amitabha, or Amitayus, himself, and his two bodhisattva attendants. A pure land, as distinct from one that is impure, is an archetypal realm which transcends conditioned existence, and which, apart from the presiding Buddha and his bodhisattvas, is inhabited exclusively by gods and men. There are hundreds of thousands of such pure lands, but the most excellent of them is Sukhavati, the pure land of Buddha Amitabha, in which are concentrated all imaginable perfections of all imaginable pure lands. In other words, what we are presented with in these three sutras is the vision of an ideally beautiful Buddha in ideally beautiful surroundings. The contemplation of beauty gives rise to love, and when the beauty contemplated is the sublime beauty of Buddhahood, as manifested in the radiant figure of Amitabha, that love takes the form of faith and devotion, through which the devotee is assimilated to the object of his devotion and achieves, in the symbolic language of the sutras, rebirth in Sukhavati. As yet, the order as a whole has not paid much attention to the three Happy Land Sutras, as I have called them elsewhere, and therefore has not derived much inspiration and guidance from them, though I myself made a close study of them many years ago, and at one time thought of lecturing on them, as I had done on other Mahayana sutras. But though we may not derive inspiration and guidance from this group of sutras directly, in a way we do so indirectly. Many Buddhas, besides Amitabha, as well as many bodhisattvas, have pure lands of their own, some of which are described in sutras. Like the Happy Land Sutras, these texts establish a kind of pattern in which a figure embodying the ideal of enlightenment occupies the center of a realm representing the conditions most conducive to the realization of that ideal. This pattern is exemplified in many of our sadhanas, in the course of which we visualize at the center of a mandala of other divinities, or of the syllables of a mantra, a Buddha or Bodhisattva who is the object of our faith and devotion, and at the same time a source of inspiration and guidance. Some of us also derive inspiration from the various hymns in praise of this or that Bodhisattva, which, though they may not be a part of Pure Land Buddhism in the Japanese sectarian form in which we usually encounter this school in the West, are nonetheless a product of that Buddhism of faith and devotion of which Pure Land Buddhism, in all its forms, is itself a part. Zen claims not to be based on any sutra or group of sutras. In the words of the well-known stanza, in which it summarizes itself and defines its attitude, it is a special transmission outside the scriptures, does not depend upon words and letters, points directly to the mind, and realizes Buddhahood by seeing into one's own nature. Historically speaking, however, Zen seems to have come into existence in its original form as Chan among a group of Chinese students of the Lankavatara Sutra, though later the work was superseded by the Diamond Sutra and, to a lesser extent, by the Surangama Sutra and the Vimalakirti Nirdesa. For practical purposes, Zen bases itself on collections of anecdotes of the sayings and doings of ancient masters of the school, such as the Blue Cliff Record and the Gateless Gate. Despite its aversion to scriptural studies, it has in fact produced a vast literature, little of which has been translated into any European language. Probably the classic Zen texts from which we in the order have derived most inspiration are the Sutra of Huailang, Huineng, otherwise known as the Platform Scripture, and Hakuin's Song of Enlightenment, both of which are characterized by an emphasis on the necessity of direct realization of the highest spiritual truth. For some of us, inspiration also comes from Zen by way of the poetry of Basho and Rokyan, with its appreciation of natural beauty, its sympathy for all forms of life, and its total disregard of unessentials, as well as by way of those other arts which, under the influence of Zen, were transformed into paths to enlightenment. Nor must I forget to mention the words of the Tang Dynasty master, Pei Chang, which, after reverberating down the centuries and creating a distinctively Zen form of monasticism, have influenced our ideas about how the movement and its activities should be supported. The famous words, "A day of no working is a day of no eating." Tibetan Buddhism is based on the Kangyur and Tungyur, and, in the case of some of its subdivisions, on the Rinchen Termo, as well as on a variety of orally transmitted teachings. Broadly speaking, it represents a transplantation to the soil of Tibet of the entire heritage of Buddhist spirituality, thought, and culture, as this existed in northern India at the time of the Pala dynasty. Prominent among the works of Tibetan origin, from which we in the order have so far derived inspiration and guidance, are the Bardo Todol, better known as the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the biography and songs of Milarepa, the life and liberation of Padmasambhava, Gampopa's Jewel Ornament of Liberation, and the various texts translated in Geshe Wangyal's Door of Liberation. It is noteworthy that two of these works, the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the Life and Liberation of Padmasambhava, are Nyingma Termas, while the biography and songs of Milarepa and Gampopa's Jewel Ornament of Liberation are of Kagyu provenance. Both the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the Life and Liberation of Padmasambhava, moreover, are characterized by extreme richness of imagery, a richness which characterizes Tibetan Buddhism as a whole, especially in its ritual and iconographic aspects. Probably, it is in the archetypal images of Tibetan religious art, even more than in their literary counterparts in the two termas, that many of us find a great part of the inspiration we derive from Tibetan Buddhism. Be that as it may, there is no doubt that Tibetan Buddhist iconography is popular throughout the Euro-American wing of the movement, though for my part, I would like to see Japanese Buddhist art enjoying equal popularity. Such, then, are the general characteristics of the Theravada, of Pure Land Buddhism, of Zen, of Tibetan Buddhism, especially insofar as these characteristics constitute for us in the order, as well as throughout the FWBO, a source of inspiration and spiritual guidance. We derive that inspiration and guidance, however, not so much from these schools in the form in which they survive in the East and have been introduced in the West, as from a selection of the scriptures on which, in principle, they respectively are based. As I pointed out when speaking of the Buddhist world, traditional Buddhism, undermined as it is, both within and without, is in a state of decline. Actually, it has been in a state of decline for a very long time, in that all four schools, in their different ways and in varying degrees, have tended to emphasize what is secondary in Buddhism at the expense of what is primary. This fact has an important bearing on the whole question of the relation of the order to the rest of the Buddhist world, or rather to the schools of which, for practical purposes, it consists, so far as we are concerned. Which brings me to the second of my three principles.